This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. It is now week two of the trial involving admissions practices at Harvard University. And what we're learning from this trial involves more than just the case that's being heard. A lawsuit from the group Students for Fair Admissions claims that Harvard discriminates against Asian American applicants. And Harvard maintains that race is just one factor that it takes into account to create a diverse student body, and it denies that any discrimination is going on. But the 6 days of testimony in this trial have raised questions about Harvard admissions and college admissions in general, especially involving issues related to economic diversity and whether that should be considered in admissions as well. We want to spend some time today talking about these questions, this trial, and about defining diversity on campus. Listeners, we want to hear from you. Should economics be considered in college admissions, and how? How do you define diversity? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. And first, we're going to go to WBUR Edify reporter Max Larkin, who has been following this Harvard trial. Welcome, Max.
Hi, Deb.
So tell us what happened today.
Well, you had top Harvard officials on the stand for the second day in a row, and they're being asked about the kind of efforts they've made to find a way to build the kind of diverse class they want without resorting to race, without considering race at all. The Supreme Court has asked that colleges like Harvard make a good faith effort to find so-called race-neutral approaches to fostering diversity. So lawyers for the group suing Harvard, Students for Fair Admissions, are grilling deans and other top officials about whether they really have done that.
And what does Harvard say?
They say first of all, that we convened two separate commissions. Harvard convened two separate commissions that were designed to look into that question. They said at the end of that process of looking at it, they said they found no workable way to use race or they found no workable way to build a diverse and really academically excellent student body without recourse to race.
And now there's also been talk about socioeconomics and that kind of diversity in a student body. How's that been addressed in court, Max?
It started to come up in earnest yesterday, Deb, and I think it's a fascinating thing that's always been in the background here. So Harvard more and more has a racial breakdown that largely matches that of the country. But it's much more skewed when it comes to income, like most universities in this country, certainly most elite universities. So Harvard pulls about the same number of students from the richest 1% of American households, the richest 1%, as from the bottom 60% in terms of income. Some people say that's a staggering gap, and they say it's an argument that Harvard should basically ditch race as a consideration and start to focus on pulling from that disproportionately Black, Latino, Asian tranche of American society and focus on, in a sense, recruiting poorer students. And you'd get a lot more diversity from that anyway. But I spoke to Anthony Jack, who teaches at Harvard, and he used to be one of the kids in this group. He was an African-American undergraduate at Amherst College from a poor background in Miami. He says you can't consider race and class separately.
To ignore race is to say that inequality does not exist in many ways, because social class is not the only thing that keeps students from applying or attending or excelling at institutions like Harvard and Yale and Princeton and Penn, or also our public state flagships like Michigan and Virginia and Berkeley.
So he says, don't ignore race. So what does Harvard say about this?
Yeah, Harvard says basically that there are, you know, there are two different kinds of disadvantage that they might encounter. They are always looking for students who come up against adversity, and that adversity could be discrimination on the basis of race or some of the obstacles that come up for people who are low income in their lives, barriers to entry into that elite part of society. I think SFFA, the group suing Harvard, is trying to show that Harvard, though it purports to really support diversity, it hasn't cultivated it in every sense. And, you know, I wanted to play some tape here. We have Lawrence Bacow on this program, who said some time ago that students from the upper tiers of society, students whose parents went to Harvard, they tend to make better undergraduates because they have a sense of what it takes to go to the school.
As a group, the legacies are an extraordinarily accomplished group of applicants who, independent of the admissions process and how it selects them, have a leg up because they know and they understand the institution and they know and understand what it takes to thrive and succeed at the institution. So their applications tend to be, you know, well put together. They have deep knowledge of the institution. So it's a self-selected pool, which as a group, by almost any metric, looks very, very good relative to the broader applicant pool.
Hmm, right. Almost people groomed to go to Harvard. But obviously that's a controversial thing to say. I wonder, Max, part of Harvard's motivation for wanting to create a diverse student body is to reflect society at large. It is said, what do we know from this trial about its efforts to do that and whether it's been successful?
Well, like I said, the racial breakdown of the college largely reflects the racial breakdown of the country. In some categories, tellingly, when it comes to Asian Americans, there are many, many more Asian Americans, around 20% in the most recent incoming class at Harvard than there are in America at large. But I think the most salient way in which it isn't reflecting the country is the relatively low percentage of students who come from low-income households, first-generation college families. Raj Chetty, an economist who actually works at Harvard, found that the median income of students there in the period he observed was around $150,000. That's quite high by American standards, and yet it's not even close to the highest median income among Massachusetts universities or among Ivy League colleges. And yet at the same time, you do have more and more poor students at Harvard. They've made an effort, and they say it's difficult to find yourself at this elite institution. I spoke today to Harvard sophomore Adelson Aguas-Vivas. He's from Newburgh, New York, family immigrated from the Dominican Republic, and he said he's had to do a lot of catching up as a poor student.
It definitely makes you feel like you stand out in a way when you first come here, because there are these kids that have all these resources that you don't necessarily have. You don't know how to navigate that. You don't know how to get an internship, join a club, write a decent paper.
But I'd say at the same time, Adelson said he had to seek out people who were like him, students from low-income communities, and they kind of banded together. And he is a staunch defender of the admissions policy as it was, which would have advantaged him as a student of color from a poor community.
Okay, I want to have some others join the conversation now. With us in studio, Raul Fernandez, program director and lecturer at the Boston University Wheelock College of Education and Human Development. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Pleasure to be here, Deborah.
Also on the line is Stephanie Niles, who's vice president for enrollment and communications at Ohio Wesleyan University and president of the National Association for College Admissions Counseling. Welcome, Stephanie.
Thank you so much.
And also, listeners, don't forget, we do want to hear from you during this part of our show, rather, about this topic. How important is diversity in the college admissions process, and how do you define it? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And, Raul, I'm wondering, as you look at this Harvard trial and you hear what Max Larkin has just told us about the trial and what we're hearing regarding the admissions process, is this a big deal for admissions and for higher education in general? And what do you think it says about diversity or not diversity on college campuses?
Well, it certainly can be. I've been watching it very closely, as have our students. And there's a few things that stand out to me, including from Max's reporting here. One is this idea that Larry Bacow is saying that, let's talk about legacy preference, first of all, that these students already have a leg up before they even apply. So to further tip, as Harvard is doing, to further tip legacies and give them even more preference, I think it's really interesting that we're looking at race as the factor here and not some of the other factors that are leading to some of the disparities that we find around income and around race as well. And that's something that needs to be addressed.
Mm. So when we saw some of those statistics and the statistics that Max mentioned, that wealthy students outnumber low-income students at Harvard 23-1. Yeah. Surprising statistic, or hey, didn't we know that wealthy kids primarily went to Harvard? What are you thinking?
I think we do know that. It's one of those things that is shocking but not surprising. It's shocking to actually see those numbers. But when we actually think about about who's attending the most elite institutions in this country, that it's not at all shocking that there's that great wealth disparity. One of the things that's important is as you ask the question, you know, what does this mean for higher education more broadly? Well, it could mean a lot if this ends up at the Supreme Court, but it's important to understand that admissions at Harvard is very different and at the elite institutions than most institutions around the country. And the fact is that most college students do not go to an elite institution. And so there's a very different experience there. With that said, whatever is decided in Massachusetts is likely to be appealed by whoever loses this case to the Supreme Court. And we could end up with a decision that much more broadly impacts the use of race as a factor in admissions throughout higher education.
Why is diversity important?
Well, the Supreme Court has said in the past that there is a compelling interest to institutions to have a diverse student body. The question is, compelling to whom? So to the institutions themselves, to be able to bring people together from diverse backgrounds to learn from one another and then to have a sort of more educated, more thoughtful citizenry for sure. But there's been a real question on college campuses, and this is the issue of climate, as to whether or not diversity, bringing in students of color, is to the benefit of white students at that institution, but not to the benefit of those students of color. So every institution is touts whatever level of diversity they have. There's not one where you can look at their mission statement or website and say they're not diverse in some way, shape, or form. But certainly, one of the things that we heard Dean Fitzsimmons say during the trial this week is really about this legacy of racism in America, and that one of the things that Harvard at least is trying to do is to account for that in preferencing in particular black students in their admissions.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I want to bring Stephanie into the conversation. Stephanie Niles, can you tell me what you were thinking as the president of the National Association for College Admissions Counseling, as you hear what's happening in this trial?
Absolutely. I mean, both in that role as well as being a chief enrollment officer myself, I've had many of the same thoughts as Raul just reflected. I think that indeed, race is a factor that institutions are taking into consideration. We see our educational institutions are, by being more diverse, they are better able to educate a population of students who can think critically, who can consider different backgrounds, different perspectives, different ways of thought if they themselves are exposed to people whose backgrounds are different than their own. Mm-hmm. That's race, that's socioeconomic status, that's religion, that's a wide variety of factors that each individual brings to a college campus as they then share their thoughts and ideas in a classroom setting where they have that freedom to debate and discuss and rationalize and think differently about what they've grown up thinking or the background they've come from. They're better able to then take that broader perspective out into the community.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, do you, when you hear the statistics that we heard, for example, in the Boston Globe, that wealthy students outnumber low-income students at Harvard 23-1, what do you think about socioeconomic diversity and how to possibly change that? Or does it matter?
Yeah, I agree that it isn't surprising to hear that. I do think it's also important, as Raul said, to note that Harvard is one institution. The vast majority of students go to school at institutions that are not Harvard, and many of them reflect a much more diverse population of students, including socioeconomic status.
But I guess, I don't mean to interrupt, but I guess, and I'm going to ask Raul this too, I mean, if you're saying, well, that's the top school, so that's okay if it's the top school and that's primarily wealthy? I mean, isn't that further separating things?
I guess so. You also have to ask, is it indeed the top school, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, isn't the top school the place where each individual student will excel? A student who is best prepared to meet the challenges that they intend to encounter in the world, that's the best school for them. That may not be Harvard. That may be Harvard. It depends. I truly believe it depends on the individual student, and it isn't just about the school that is ranked the best, but the school where that student can thrive and excel.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I want to make sure we get some time in to take calls as well. Listeners, remember, we want to hear from you about this. Should diversity be considered in college admissions? How and how do you define diversity? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. David is calling from Lexington. David, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I think diversity of income and class is more important than racial diversity, although I think that's somewhat important too. But we have in this country an expanding Gini quotient, which is, I think, one of the top two Gini quotients in the among Western industrialized nations. And it's getting worse. And politically, people are bending the rules so that the rich are getting ever richer. And I think having, you know, a bunch of lower class people at Harvard with a much better ratio than 1-23 so that the upper class people at Harvard can get to know them and hear their stories might help do something about this problem in the future, which you know, mere racial diversity. I live in a racially diverse neighborhood where the average house is probably worth close to $1 million, and you know, we're not that different from each other. It's nothing like the difference between me and someone who's grown up in a bad part of town with the family income of $20,000 or $30,000. And I just think that Harvard could do the country a great service by having a lot more diversity of class.
Okay. Well, thanks, David, very much for the call. Raul, I want to ask you, I wonder, you know, Harvard has said that, you know, it does admit wealthy students, and in part it does that because it helps it admit more low-income students, right? So who otherwise wouldn't be able to enroll, right? We're charging them full tuition here, and we're able to offer more assistance to lower-income students. Is that fair? And many schools have said that, right? They say that it helps us. So, you know, if we admit wealthier students, they're helping to subsidize the lower income students. Is that fair?
Well, it's certainly fair in the case of other institutions. But in the case of a Harvard or a Stanford or Yale or others with endowments that are $30 billion plus, Harvard could, if it wanted, offer free tuition to every student that attended there and still be able to have enough money to run its operations and would likely be able to still bring in the kind of funding that they do through alumni relations and other forms. So for Harvard, if this was their argument, to say that we'd go broke if it wasn't for these high income students coming to our institution, I think that's just a fallacy. That might have been the case maybe a couple hundred years ago, but not today. I do want to mention one other thing. This pitting of whether or not we need to preference low income students or racial minorities, I think is unhelpful. If we're looking, and we have the data on this, but if we're looking at what is crowding out both racial minorities and low-income students, it is these other preferences. It is preference at Harvard, for instance, around legacy admissions, around students with athletic abilities, and many, many other things that we see coming out in the secret sauce in this trial. Mm-hmm. If you listen to Dean Fitzsimmons, who's being forced begrudgingly to tell the world how Harvard does its admissions, and we can see that what's crowding out students is not this preference for low-income students or for racial minorities. It's all these other things.
Hmm. So, Stephanie Niles, can you weigh in there in terms of legacy and athletics and those types of admissions criteria on colleges? I mean, do those need to change so we can have more diversity?
I think it also goes to the diversity of our classes. You know, again, diversity is so broadly defined. And so we're trying to put together diverse student bodies. We're trying to populate our athletic teams, our orchestras, our student governments. We're trying to bring in students who represent that broad variety of backgrounds in terms of their abilities and accomplishments, in terms of their perspectives, and in terms of how they'll contribute to our campus climate. So I would argue that those factors are part of the diversity that each institution is trying to build.
Mm-hmm. You know, we heard a cut from Ayla Shapiro in our billboard to the show today, who was on Radio Boston earlier this month, senior fellow at the Cato Institute, and said, you know, replacing white privileged kids of doctors and lawyers with black privileged kids of doctors and lawyers doesn't seem like adding diversity. So I get the point, but how would you measure sort of socioeconomic diversity and use that as a criteria for admission, Stephanie?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question again?
So how do you make sure that you're achieving socioeconomic diversity? What's your income standard? How do you know when it's when you're achieving a more diverse student body?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I think that I guess I'm not fully aware of there being a specific metric around that each institution would be held to. There's so many complicating factors that figure into how every institution puts together its class from a financial perspective. You know, it was stated earlier that, you know, Harvard is different. Harvard could indeed meet the need of every student who applies. That just isn't the case at the vast majority of institutions in this country. And so we do have to really look at what are the revenue needs that each institution must meet and how can we generate them. And it varies greatly across institutions and institutional types.
Okay. Max Larkin, I'm wondering what happens with the Harvard trial from here?
Well, we've got a lot more to go. It's a 3-week trial, and we can expect that we're going to hear not just the end of the plaintiff's case, but we'll be hearing, for instance, from amici, friends of the court. So students who've been affected by this policy and generally praise the policy are going to get a chance to testify. Then Harvard will present its case that what it's doing is not only compliant with the law, but beneficial, kind of necessary for its institutional priorities.
Okay. WBUR Edify reporter Max Larkin, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Deb.
Also, Raul Fernandez, program director and lecturer at the Higher Education Administration at the Boston University Wheelock College of Education and Human Development. Thank you.
Thanks, Deb.
Stephanie Niles, Vice President for Enrollment and Communications at Ohio Wesleyan and President of the National Association for College Admissions Counseling. Thanks to you as well.
Thank you very much.
And listeners, stay with us. Coming up, we talk with a Rhode Island doctor who says it's time for a healthcare revolution. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.